Today is the 18th of March. I'm Andreas Droulias and I'm here with Michael Kraus so that we can do an interview about his lecture in Quebec, right? Okay. Yeah, so Michael.
Yeah, what I'll try to do is reconstruct the informal talk, autobiographical talk that I gave in Quebec the last day of the little conference there, which was being held in a sense in my honor, but more importantly was a conference on the theme of reciprocity, circularity, in the relationship between indigenous knowledge and Western academic knowledge, combining as a two-way or reciprocal or circular process, as opposed to the traditional academic investigator, linguist, or anthropologist collects information from indigenous peoples in such a way that it benefits academe, but in a way feeds back to the people to benefit them. This is a whole new direction in linguistic and anthropological work, which is by no means widespread yet. The older paradigm, I think, still reigns almost exclusively supreme, and the kind of approach that Igor Krupnik and I have so much in common is barely beginning to become common, let alone acceptable. My main interest in this whole enterprise is to try to make this kind of progress in the anthropological linguistics field, so that indigenous life and academic life may become mutually enriching and engage in something that leads to open-ended progress instead of one shot, one dia, where one merely exploits the other. And as a explanation of how I arrived at this, I go then into a autobiographical tale of myself, as invited by the conference. I was born in 1934 in a very comfortable, affluent suburb, to live in a very affluent, comfortable suburb of Cleveland, Ohio, where my father was a general surgeon practicing during the Depression, and where I grew up in a highly assimilative Jewish sub-community of that suburb. The only language I ever heard around me as a child was English. I don't think I was ever aware of the presence of, God forbid, Yiddish, but was taught some Hebrew as a child in Sunday school. And in spite of the assimilationism of the times and the people, there was still, at the very same time, at least in my family and in many others, a strong respect for the traditional roots and certainly values, and to some extent even behaviors of our Jewish ancestors, however Americanized we had otherwise become. And that alone was already something that many people do not have the benefit of, that those roots are discarded in the Americanization. But instead, I learned through my entire upbringing that there is diversity, not only in this world, but also even in our American world, and that we have our own very important contribution to make in the old ways that we came from, though in some ways discarded, or not discarded, but abandoned or suspended, are nevertheless of value, and there was always great respect for that and great respect for learning the ancestral and liturgical language. And that was my first exposure to another language as a strong symbol of identity and nationhood, where, in fact, although we were Americans, we had our own identity within that as a kind of dual identity which breaks the rule or the oversimplified pattern of mankind as belonging must perforce belong taxonomically into a single identity, namely American or Iraqi, and which means you're supposed to forget, I guess, that you're a Kurd or Shia or whatever, or in this country that you can't be a Jew and an American, or I guess a Turk, a Bulgarian and a Turk, or that there can be overlaps and combinations of identities, and not that all mankind must be pigeonholed hermetically into these straight taxonomical organization that you could express in your high school outline, 1A, B, C, D, 2A, B, C, and so on, that mankind does not have to fit into such a pattern. And I used to see, although, that language had a great deal to do with identity and, for example, also social class. I think the only linguistics that I learned in elementary school, which I could immediately see, was taking these little tests where you're supposed to fill in which is or a multiple choice, which is, quotes, better, or which is right, not wrong. Them boys ain't there, or those boys aren't there. And of course, everyone knew how to fill those in a way. Anyone who says them boys ain't there has also heard them boys aren't there, those boys aren't there, but chooses not to speak that way because they have membership in a society that, or in a class of society that says it another way. And it seemed so stupid and so clear to me that this was nothing more than a kind of smug reinforcement of social hierarchy as a vertical scale, where we were supposed to belong to the top and stop saying ain't or them boys, lest you don't belong to the top where everyone in my suburb supposed to belong. So that linguistics was really a kind of social hierarchy reinforcement mechanism to teach you to speak right or to say it, quotes, better, that there was a right way and a wrong way or a good way or a bad way and a better way, and that if you want to make that kind of money or belong to this social class, you say it one way or another. And it isn't. It seemed like an extremely stupid question in any sense other than that of social hierarchy. And I learned early what this kind of public linguistics really meant, and was always very sensitive to language and interested in it. I had some junior high school Latin and was becoming more and more of a misfit in my own society because I never quite abided by the values of this social structure. And felt very lucky to be admitted to the University of Chicago under the Hutchins program, where you could go out of 10th grade straight into the University of Chicago, which I did in the year then 1950 at the age of 16. And where we were, instead of taken to mixers and orientations, a packet of papers was dumped on our bed in our cell, so to speak, in that dormitory, which I remember rather vividly, and that we were supposed to read and then take some what they called placement tests. I was totally unprepared for this, or I didn't know what was going on, but dutifully read the papers. One was about mathematical theory of braiding, I remember that, and of braids, and there were a lot of other things, the likes of which I had never seen before in my life, and I tried my best, and it turned out that I was exonerated from, passed out of, a year's worth of courses there. Unfortunately, thus skipping any education, college education, in those very fields for which I had any real talent, and was left with a steady, solid diet of nothing but those subjects for which I had no particular talent. And it was a tough time. I also had a girlfriend in New York and held extra part-time jobs to make plane fare for commuting to New York over those years. That was a tough period, but I did manage to graduate with mediocre grades, but came out of there a perfectly well-rounded Hutchinsian scholar. And with no ability to do anything in any area for which I had any talent. That was slightly cured by going back home to Cleveland the next year at 1953 at Western Reserve University, where I enrolled in nothing but language, French and Italian. The French I took second and third year French, although I'd never had any before, and naturally got a B in second year, which is more literature type, and an A in third year, which is more language type, and did well, got through a good bit of Dante in Italian, and but stayed away from, and this is typical, I guess, of me, of languages which at that time seemed to me imperialistic type languages, taking more the less, more innocently underdog languages like French and Italian compared to, say, Russian or German, which had less attractive connotations for the likes of me. So I graduated with a second BA at the end of 1953-54, and with a major in Romance languages, and went on to from there to Columbia University for a master's degree in Romance philology, which is much more, of course, well, for me at least, linguistic than literary, and it was fairly definitive by then already to me. I was now 17 or 18, that my real talents and interests lay in language itself as opposed to language in order to gain access to a literature or a culture. It was more language for language's sake.
What exactly is Romance philology?
Romance philology is the linguistic study of the languages descended from Latin, French, Spanish, Italian, and so on, and how they evolved from vulgar Latin into the modern spoken languages. But while I was at it at Columbia, I started taking courses in linguistics itself, which were given most especially by André Martinet, who was there from France during those years, giving courses in general linguistics and in Indo-European. I remember taking a seminar with him at his apartment in Greek, and we got his, through the Xenophon's first part, I guess, of the Anabasis, up to Talata, and Ptis Pternute. And someone sneezed, and sure enough, they were delivered. So I remember that as a very dramatic part of my education. But Martinet's broad approach, at the same time, sort of classical Indo-Europeanistics, and was by far the most inspiring teaching I had ever had the privilege of experiencing up to that point. And discovered there, although the degree was technically in Romance philology, that I was a linguist. And it turned out that that year became Martinet's last year at Columbia. And the following year, he went back to the University of Paris, and I followed him there to the École des Hautes Études and Sorbonne, and continued not only in linguistics, but this is where the direction is taking still clearer shape. Fell under the spell of Professor Bachelieri, Edouard Bachelieri. He had fought in World War II and was wounded and was nursed back to health by a Welsh nurse. And in the process, he learned Welsh. And married this nurse and became a Welsh-speaking citizen of Paris with his children, and a professor of Celtic languages, Breton, but he'd also studied Irish and Old Irish, and started taking courses with him in Old Irish and in Celtic philology or Celtic linguistics, which was absolutely hypnotizing for me. And the reason for that was, I'm sure, that these were not only very exotic Indo-European, they were very definitely very different languages from the Romance languages, number one. But number two, they were the most, I'm sure, what appealed to me more than anything is that these were Breton under French and Welsh and Gaelic languages under English were endangered minority languages that were socially subordinated to, again, encroaching languages, French having become one of the encroachers and dominant languages, arrogantly intolerant of other languages. And that cause of being able to be Gaelic-speaking and still be, ironically, still be, quotes, an Englishman, or that's a horrible way of putting it, but to speak a indigenous language, in this case, of the British Isles or the Breton Peninsula, Brittany, and still be, can you still be French and Breton? Those are ironic and very difficult issue, which I've been grappling with, I realize, all my life. So from 1955, 56, I spent in Paris. The French was just, by then, a language for practical use of in the classwork and so on that I did at the Sorbonne, but my real interest, I discovered, lay in these minority endangered languages. So as a result of that, in 1956, I traveled to Ireland, showed up in Dublin at the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies, spoke, this was a very special school set up by the Irish Republic that had two institute that had two schools in it, the School of Cosmic Physics on the one hand and the School of Celtic Languages on the other. I naturally was on the side of the Celtic languages and impressed them, I guess, maybe so much with my enthusiasm for Irish Gaelic and interest in it that they gave me a stipend for the year 56-57 of an entire £50, which back then was no small money. Back then that was like $250. And that was enough for me to cross the country and get the steamer to an Angus. Where I landed on Inis Mian, in the middle of the three Aran Islands in Galway Bay. And I was already had a few words of Gaelic. People there were still at that time very dominantly, and in some cases still monolingually, Gaelic speaking. The population at that time was over 200, maybe closer to 300. I simply got off the steamer into a Corach and landed in through the breakers and explained what I was doing there, which to the people of Inis Mian was not that astounding because they had had visitors from the time of John Singh and even earlier who had come to that island to become immersed in Gaelic. And so they did understand that their language was worthy enough for somebody from even foreign country to want to come and learn. And they were most hospitable to me. I lived in the house first of a man by the name of Martin Og, young Martin, although he was quite an old man by then, and became known on the island as Mikilin Wartin Og. Michelin, the diminutive of Michael, of the household of Martin Aug. And when their son returned from abroad, and they didn't have room then, I moved into another house and spent the rest of over a year on that island, never speaking anything but Irish, and participating actively in a culture which was entirely, or almost entirely, self-supporting, basically a kind of 19th century technology. There was not, there were not even really wheeled vehicles on the island. It was everything on the back of people or donkeys. And Friday was big night because being meatless Friday, we actually had fish, because the rest of the time we didn't have fish. And it was a the diet was very heavily potatoes, which I helped with, and became to support myself in a sense, or to make my presence worthwhile there. And meanwhile, all my other time I spent poring over the books, and above all socializing and developing strong relationships with people there in a Gaelic culture. There were young men my age there who did not speak English, or certainly even more, who did not speak it comfortably. It was virtually the very, very end of dominantly Gaelic-speaking world, and where the conquest of the Sassenachs, namely, of course, guess who, that the place had not become entirely Saxonized, and there was still a Celtic, Celtic, Gaelic world, albeit essentially at that time materially pretty much 19th century style, but had a strong spirit on the island, and there was tremendous hemorrhaging of the population, of the young people going off to Boston and such places, never to be seen again, but at least back then. So it was a tragic situation, but at the same time, it was a poignantly Gaelic life, and I would dare say, for my being such a misfit in my own culture, I found something there that really confirmed my faith in mankind and real values. Those were people who, in my view, the kind of people that I most enjoyed sharing my life with. And in fact, when I left there, it was a tremendous, wrenching and painful event for me, too, especially for me, as I had no idea if I would ever come back. And especially I had a very dear friend there that I had a hard time leaving instead of marrying and settling down there. Because I was, by then, 22 years old, I guess, yeah. It was certainly the most formative year of my life, if I look back on those things. I needed, well, I found out at the end of that year that Harvard had was giving me a fellowship to get my PhD there in the Department of Celtic Studies. They had, in addition to linguistics, they were one of the few departments in the United States universities who had a Celtic languages department, and I ostensibly went there for that reason, to do my PhD, which in a way, since I had so deeply internalized Irish, so much to the point where it still comes out on the rare occasions that I meet Gaelic speakers now after 50 years, that I can still blurt out, because it sunk kind of deep into my skull, and it has never entirely left me. And by the time I get going after a few hours in Gaelic now, which is a rare occasion, so it's amazing how it comes back to me. But anyway, I didn't. In order to get back to Harvard, I needed some money, so I went and got a job in Oslo through the university, university student dormitory town.
Okay, I think we are back on. Yeah.
Okay. Student dormitory town on the outskirts of Oslo, where I managed wisely to get a very blue-collar job on the garbage detail, where I spent a large part of the summer then dumping garbage at the Oslo garbage dump, and which is one of the few places in Oslo where people would speak to you in Norwegian.
So,
because anywhere near the university, surely everyone would be practicing their English on you.
Yeah.
So I was it was very clever of me to have managed to get this plum of a job on the garbage department. And that was the summer of 1957 when the International Congress of Linguists took place at the University of Oslo, and so I had that experience in the middle of all of this, and there were many things that happened there, including the wonderful first meeting I ever had with Knut Bergsland, who became a long time colleague for all of my time a few years later when I came to University of Alaska, and had the privilege of working with him on his Aleut life's avocation, you might say. And so that's where that began. Then, which did earn me enough money for a boat ticket back to the States. There I turned myself in, you might say, at Harvard, back into respectable academe in the Celtic and linguistics departments, but found that I had become by then a worse misfit for traditional academic life than ever I had been before, and in addition to that, I suppose I had the honor of being one of the very few, maybe only, Harvard graduates who can say that they found more education there through the custodial staff than through the faculty. That's easy to explain. Boston is a graveyard of Gaelic, and the main destination of Gaelic speakers from Ireland, and the Harvard custodial staff had at least its share of Gaelic speakers, with whom I had a great deal in common, and who knew lots more Gaelic than any of the Celtic department faculty. On the one hand, on the other, the linguistics department was somewhat beleaguered there, you might say, being 2 miles up the street from MIT, where Noam Chomsky was starting to cause a lot of trouble. And 2 miles up or down Mass Ave, Chomsky had just published Syntactic Structures, or was just publishing Syntactic Structures, and we were rather carefully kept at the Harvard end of Massachusetts Avenue, not advised to go down there. I made a few trips and met Roman Jakobson there too, but I was pretty badly out of it. I wrote my dissertation there, but with a lot of frustration. I don't think that anybody on my committee really read it or really understood it. I think it made a contribution, but it was such a simplification in a way of a very interesting phonological system of the language, and which I had a very different but undeniable way of looking at, and its relationship to the orthography of the language is an area of linguistics that has always interested me, and it's clear that the seeds of so much of what I ended up doing in Alaska are already in that dissertation as I look occasionally back on it. I had already, after that, signed up to go to Iceland on a fellowship from the American Scandinavian Foundation on money that the Nobel Prize-winning Icelandic novelist Halldór Kiljan Laxness had left in the States, in large part because, having pinky leanings, to put it mildly, Laxness had made himself somewhat unpopular in the States, and somehow or other his money got, he couldn't use the money or it got left behind, and so he gave it to the foundation to for scholarships for Americans to come to Iceland, and so I became, I don't know if I was the first one, but it was already I was signed up to go to Iceland on a postdoc when I defended my dissertation at Harvard in September of 1958. And from there I went on to Iceland. And the reason, of course, for my attraction to Iceland, one, I had become involved with Scandinavian languages in part because of their close relationship to, that is, a close social, their invasions of British Isles, Ireland certainly being no exception, or the Isle of Man and other Gaelic-speaking places, and the Hebrides. So I had contact with Norwegians back then, including Bergsland, but Iceland as a small, isolated country that had nevertheless very doggedly hung on to its language as a top, as a most valuable part of their own heritage. And that's another story in and of itself. Iceland was in fact settled by the nobility of the displaced nobility of Norway under the unification of Harald, and the Vikings just happened to have discovered Iceland at the time, which thitherto had been populated only by Irish monks, these relations attracted me enormously to Iceland because of the fact that it was also a smallish nation that had really made it with its language, which they had kept in because of this tremendous level of literacy, kept in a very low rate of evolution, so that it was virtually the same and still intelligible in a sense to Old Norse. And in Iceland, I certainly became deeply involved with Iceland, but at the same time, there used to be back then Iceland is pretty purely Icelandic, and the only foreigners you would find there really were these strange people that used to wear this funny-looking Jacobin reddish cap. Their trousers were a different cut, and the Icelanders always used to make fun of these people, the Faroese from the Faroe Islands. You can always tell a Faroese by the way they walk. They walk like they're not going anywhere. And it was the one people at the nation still smaller than Iceland that the Icelanders had to look down upon and feel better than. I discovered in the process the Faroese had their own language, which had much more dialectal variation within it than ever did Icelandic. And it was only about half as conservative as Icelandic, but much, much more so than any other Scandinavian language next to Icelandic. This is a smaller country, a smaller set of islands with a population that back in 1790s was a mere 5,000. By the time I got there, 30-some thousand, who had, in the 1790s, it was said that their language was going to disappear and they were going to become Danicized, but in fact, so people started writing down the ballads that they still danced ring dances to. But somehow or other, their language never did die. In fact, it was just as alive as Icelandic, and even by the time I got there in 1958, they were printing their own money in Faroese, even though they're still part of Denmark, it was Danish crowns, but printed in Faroese, and their school was entirely in Faroese, and they were coming along with the literature, although by no means of the same age as Icelandic. Really became a written language only in the 1840s, along with so many other European languages in this national romantic movement, which maybe saved them. The language was entirely vigorous, and the radio station broadcasting all the time in Faroese. They had their own newspapers, about five of them in Faroese. It was amazingly a thriving culture and community, and it was June when I would go there for the beginning of the summer, and Olasok, or the national holiday, and danced the ring dances, and I became very much involved in that, such that after those 2 years in Iceland and the Faroes, spending maybe three quarters of my time in Iceland and one quarter of it in the Faroes, that looking back upon it, I wish that I had it the other way around, because here I go again. My usual gravitation toward the still smaller underdog nations despised by Breton, despised by the French, here Faroese somewhat despised by the Icelanders. I used to come back from the Faroes to Iceland and try to give talks around various places in Iceland about their wonderful neighbors, the Faroese, and the Faroese have some pretty marvelous literature and especially poetry and so on, but that always went over rather unsuccessfully in Iceland. Nodded politely, but they were, and I guess there must have been quite a spectacle to see an American telling them in Icelandic about how nice the Faroese are. So I don't think I made a big hit in that respect, at least in Iceland. I learned a lot there, and I met Jóhann Eichel, a dear colleague my own generation, and there were a couple of Greenlanders who came through there that I made a point of meeting, Danny Lennartsen, for example, who's a teacher in Greenland, and saw what the Greenlanders were doing with their language and so on. That was my first contact ever with Eskimo-type language. And but my, in some ways, my most vivid memories of those 2 years are of my contacts with the Faroese and even secondarily the Greenlanders, as much as with the Icelanders themselves. And it came out of there with a lesson about how, unlike the Irish, which is very controversial and very in the final result of which is still in the air, and that's an interesting subject too, how you could say maybe the Gaeltacht, the Gaelic-speaking districts, will not survive, but the so the survival of Irish will fail, whereas the revival of Irish may succeed. Those who lost the language may, there are many more people in Ireland, at least statistically, speaking Gaelic to each other, who have learned it as a second language, than there are those whose native language it still is, still speaking to each other, probably 10 times as many. Well, not 10 times, but 5 times as many. Maybe I should save my one revisit to that island and what's going on there till later in this, if I'm going to keep things in chronological order. The chronological order that would then be that after my 2 years in Iceland and the Faroes, I was not as much in a quandary as to what I was destined to do with the rest of my life, because as interesting and as much of a contribution I could have made to these languages, Icelandic and Faroese in my way, maybe more in Irish, I still felt duty was to go back, especially after this contact with Eskimo, it was to go back to my own country and use my talents most beneficially to the indigenous minority languages of my own country. My own country, Cleveland, Ohio, every language in Ohio has long since, of course, been entirely extinct. I got an offer while I was still in Iceland, in fact, from the University of Alaska, I'd always had a kind of an interest in the North anyway, and it was clear that Alaska needed somebody to do something with linguistics. And it so happens that the University of Alaska in 1960 had gotten in the 50s, had gotten a series of funds for visiting professorships in new disciplines for the university. And I was hired then to begin the discipline of linguistics at the University of Alaska, which as a visiting professor. The University of Alaska never put a nickel into this, or me, in that regard. They used me as on Carnegie Foundation money to introduce linguistics to Alaska, to the University of Alaska, which I came to do on top of, however, teaching French. French was hardly a new discipline at the University of Alaska. French was taught the very first year of the university's existence, and it's the only foreign language that has never lapsed at the University of Alaska. French has been taught every year since 1923, the first academic year of the institution, and I was never allowed to forget that my bread and butter was really teaching French, even though the money that paid for me was to teach linguistics. And it never occurred to me, this is how stupid I am, it never occurred to me until 40 years later that I was there, I should have said, no, you're getting money for me to teach linguistics, not French. But they never, I was too young and naive to see the ways of the university back then. And at the same time, I had a decent relationship with the administration at the time, in part maybe because I was a bright new star there. A, B, it was, they weren't too used to, quotes, Harvard PhDs. Little did they know that I was really a PhD of Harvard custodians. And a total misfit for such a system. And the president who was new came exactly the same time as I did, William R. Wood, and we were sort of respected each other. So I started out here with a bang, although they started out with a bang on me too, without, am I not even wising up to this for over 40 years. I was originally supposed to be there for 2 years, and then who knows, and meanwhile, by the way, I had re-met on my way back, basically, through Cleveland, and then after coming here for a month, after I had taught here for September 30th, 1960, my parents were both fatally injured in an auto accident on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And I flew back on that occasion, and lo and behold, it was at my parents' funeral, but an old high school and junior high school friend that was divorcing and whom I married, Jane, and she was always a good sport and always ready for, let's put the word as a good sport. Here's a, you know, girl from a staid environment in Cleveland who has the guts to go off with a misfit like me to the wilds of Alaska, but understood only for a couple of years. Yeah, 2 years. Those 2 years ended up stretching out. But the in the 60s, I was, except for Irene Reed and Martha Tilak, and that's another story, as a faculty member, I was, of course, the only person of my type here. But the university was a much smaller place. There were 800 students, so roughly one-tenth the size of what it is now. And it was real clear that the university still sort of fancied itself as the pride of the northern wilderness, is living proof that high culture, string quartets, Shakespeare, trigonometry or calculus or whatever, geophysics and anthropology, measuring skulls, could take place in Alaska, proof that the place, the wilderness, was being conquered by the ever-victorious civilization in which we were a part. And the Greek columns on the Masonic Lodge downtown, or the glorious New California architecture of some buildings like Bunnell Building on this hill, were proving that civilization had conquered the wilderness here. And there were even people measuring the skulls of those who have come before us, and measuring their arrowheads, and very few of them paying attention, any attention. It was already a very a venerable department with a lot of prestige here, anthropology for digging up all these bones of mammals and humans, and all of these arrowheads, and it was a wonderful anthropology department. The head of which, Ivar Skylon, did pay attention to people still moving around above the ground, but really still only in the shape of their skulls. And
He was a physical
anthropologist more than anything else. Linguistics or language, who the hell ever heard or cared about that? That was totally alien to this anthropology department and to this campus. Well, I was brought up here to start, quotes, linguistics. And in my first linguistics class, well, no, let me say this too, that this university, the first, conceived of itself as the crown jewel, shall we say, of civilization in this godforsaken frozen wilderness. And true, you couldn't, there were hardly any PhDs on the faculty, for instance, so how, it couldn't be a very good university. In fact, it was kind of like a Siberia, where people who were, did not have the credentials or the competence to really function in a civil, in a real civilized university, could make it here at the edge of civilization. It was still okay. And then I came along and started perfecting the art of wallowing in being in Siberia, which caused some people maybe a little discomfort, but my interest, and I will explain in a second, grew into dealing with Alaska, and not just skulls and bones and arrowheads, but people walking above the ground talking these languages, still for the moment. When I first came here, I was, of course, appalled by the situation of Alaska Native languages. The children were forced, of course, to go to schools in virtually every village by then, but where only English was allowed, and the children were forcibly punished and forcibly dissuaded from speaking their own languages. And that was the standard policy in all native schools in Alaska at the time, to the point where I was beginning already to discover that in many parts of Alaska, already in most parts of Alaska, the children were no longer speaking the native languages, only the adults or elders. Although it isn't as bad as it is today, it was already taking shape, and Alaska was becoming triumphantly, again, the past this frontier stage. And I could go into, but I don't know if I have time here. I didn't much in Quebec either, to go into the history of the native language policies here, but let's make a story short. During the Russian period, which lasted from the 1730s to officially 1867, the Russians may have done some nasty things to the population, but the people that survived, Aleuts in particular, were still all Aleut speaking when the Russians left. They may have done some harm to the population in many cases, but never any harm to Alaska native languages. In fact, on the contrary, they had made of Aleut, firstly, secondly, Aleutiak, thirdly, Central Yupik, and fourthly, miserably fourthly, the Tlingits, had made literary languages of them, and had certainly introduced the idea of bilingual education through their church schools. Then, thank God, after the sale in 1867, Alaska was neglected. If they hadn't been neglected, it would have been the same story as outside, where the only good Indian was a dead Indian, and Alaska missed out on this period, thanks to its neglect, on this period of genocide, active genocide and displacement of the entire indigenous population. With the result that there have never been any Indian wars, no Indian was ever shot by any American soldier, with the not real exception of the shelling of Angoon, which never killed anybody. Plenty of people died, but not by being shot by Americans. There were no Indian wars here. Alaska was spared that most horrible period, and by the time the Americans really came here in the 1880s and were confronted, well, for our purposes, the gold seekers were temporary, but the canneries were along the coast and certainly devastated Eyak, first and foremost. The main culture changers were the missionaries equals school teachers, who unleashed the American system on the native population, forbidding them from teaching, from using their own language in education, unlike the Russians. And also, unlike four of